Hello, we're in Oxford. We don't have Andrew Gregory with us, but we do have Mark Johnson.
Hello.
And a cat.
We have our very own podcat.
And we have Ben, who has got a rather fluffy cat sitting on his lap. And not his own cat, in fact, because we are in a pub.
My cat's not allowed in pubs.
In Oxford, with the awesome Mark Johnson. This is episode 17 of series 2, we think, probably, of the Linux Voice podcast. We have news, we have discoveries, maybe dialed in from the missing two, which is Mike and Andrew. We're going to have No Neurons and The Voice of the Masses, which is a good subject, considering Mark sounds like he does an awful lot to organise OgCamp, which is in just a matter of 10 days?
Yeah, something like that. Sounds a lot scarier when you say it like that.
So that's it. If you like this podcast, done slightly more professionally, Linux Voice Magazine, which is what Ben and I helped to create, and it's available in lots of places. Should we go for some news?
Some news. All right, there's been quite a bit going on this fortnight. Firstly, the big news in the Linux world, one of the big bits of news, is that Debian's going back to GNOME. It had a brief dalliance with XFCE, which started in November 2013. This is the default desktop environment. Obviously, all desktop environments pretty much are available on Debian. But it switched its default, it switched from GNOME to XFCE. Now it's switching back from XFCE to GNOME. Officially, this is for accessibility and systemd integration, because apparently everything's got to be to do
everyone
with systemd. Yeah, that's all Linux is now. It's a wrapper around systemd.
What would Richard Stallman say about that? Linux was never Linux, it was always systemd.
It's now GNU / systemd.
So were they ever, they're going to, yeah, GNOME shell. So were they using GNOME 3 before they switched to XFCE, or did they switch to XFCE from GNOME 2?
Oh, this is dragging up. I'm pretty sure they switched from GNOME 3 to XFCE, and now they're switching back. And to be fair, GNOME 3 has got quite a bit better since its inception.
Yes. I noticed that Mate was also in the running. And was,
is that how you pronounce it?
We've been told that it's Mate, but I don't...
No one has ever told us
that. I don't think they react to... Well, Martin Wimpress, who's working on the Ubuntu Mate remix, doesn't react too badly if you call it Mate. But I think some other people might.
Well, when it first came out, I spent a while... They've never used an accent on the E. I know it's
it's as in yerba mate, the thing they use in the drink.
Argentina.
Yes,
but that does have an accent on it.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
At least as
I didn't
far
know
as
that.
I'm aware. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is why I've always called it mate.
You know, for the back page of the magazine where we do like a crib sheet, I think we've probably got enough of these things now to explain how it should be pronounced. You know, this GNOME and this cute and this mate.
This is just going to start a flame war. It's Linux!
Well, from what I saw on the... I only briefly looked at the Debian. And I always want to pronounce Debian as Debian. I don't know why, because it's just Deborah and Ian, isn't it?
Yeah, Debian. Yeah, but I have met people who pronounce it Debian, which there's no excuse for that as far as I'm concerned.
And so it sounded like usability was an important part of this, but so was systemd in the...
Yes.
Mate is a little bit behind.
Yeah, because they got good rating for accessibility in some of the other areas. But yeah, it was across the board on their criteria. GNOME 3 was like top dog.
So does that mean that GNOME 3 it has reached a critical mass in terms of, you know, a bit like the tipping point that KDE had when people started to use it again? They kind of, you know, sulked a little while. The cat is purring. It really loves Ben.
Just like the Queen. The purring, not liking Ben necessarily.
No, me and Liz get on quite well.
Ben is the royalist of the team.
I always thought XFCE, it doesn't seem to have done a lot in its, like, in the last few years, really. It sort of stayed at quite a level. I'm at the point now where I look more to Mate or Mate and LXDE if I'm not going to go for one of the big high-power desktops rather than XFCE, because it just feels like it's stagnating a little bit. to me at least.
I always thought that was the point with XFCE.
Maybe that's why Debian liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
It's good. I mean, it's great. I'm really pleased for, well, XFCE is great. I think it will carry on as it was, but I'm glad that the GNOME team are getting this kind of backing because they do a very good, important job.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. The next big item of news this fortnight is that Netflix is apparently going to start coming to Linux.
Ooh.
They've been waiting for Canonical to switch one of the libraries in Ubuntu.
Just Canonical then?
Well, it's all a bit up in the air at the moment because they want, because apparently Ubuntu is Linux and Linux is Ubuntu. That's all there is. Once Canonical,
if only we knew
changes.
Somebody sponsored by Ubuntu, we could ask.
So I believe they haven't actually said whether or not they won't officially support it on other platforms, but whether or not they'll actively block it like they are at the moment. Because all that's stopping it now is a user agent check.
Yeah.
On Chrome. So as long as you're using the right version of Chrome, you have the right version of the library, in principle it will work. And I would imagine what will happen is if Netflix do keep doing a user agent check to check for Ubuntu, all the other distros will just start identifying as Ubuntu. Why not, frankly?
Well, yeah, that would be an interesting watershed moment, wouldn't it? Because, yeah, I mean, I have Netflix on Linux through Pipelite.
Yeah, I do.
Which,
as well.
And a user agent spoofer, which is a pain to have to do that bit. But it would be
so
nice.
What do you have to be, Internet Explorer or something?
You just have to be anything on a platform which Silverlight supports.
Right.
So because Silverlight doesn't support Linux, it sees you on Linux and says, oh, you can't possibly have Silverlight, so you can't run.
Right, right.
So yeah, I think I just say I'm Firefox on Windows and it's fine. But yeah, so I mean, the actual, it's an encryption library, isn't it? They want updated because it's working through the HTML5 encrypted media extension.
Yeah, it's libnss.
Right.
NNS, I forget which one.
So, yeah, in a way, this is almost the vindication of encrypted media extensions because it means that we're getting support for this kind of thing on Linux, right? It's what users want.
What I've always said with it is I hate DRM, but the choice isn't between DRM and not DRM. It's choice between something work on Linux and something not work on Linux. There's always going to be DRM, or will be for a long time, because people don't care enough to actually stop
it. Yeah.
It's just whether or not it was going to be something that worked across all browsers or some horrible proprietary plugin from Adobe or someone or Microsoft. I just poked the cat in the eye. By accident, I should point out.
I think we've talked about this at length, didn't we? At least when we were talking about the encryption extensions to HTML5. And I think I was quite against it. And I still am in principle. But it's still good news that there's some semi-official support coming to Ubuntu for Netflix. I mean, I subscribe to Netflix, I have to be honest. You know, even if it's through a PlayStation and my Android phone, it's only going to make Linux a more legitimate platform for other people.
Yeah.
Switching away from Linux a little bit, for our next side of reviews, Minecraft is now Microsoft Craft. the computing giant has paid $2.5 billion. How can any game be worth $2.5 billion?
I don't know.
They've got a lot of merchandise these days.
That's true.
I think it's the mindshare, really, though. That's what's probably worth the money.
Yeah. Suddenly we're all going to think Microsoft is nice and cuddly or blocky.
Blocky, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I tweeted about this, and in fact, Alan responded to the tweet that, whatever they are in digits, it's a huge number for a single platform. But then, I mean, I'm not massively into gaming, but Destiny was a big release from last week. I think that cost something like $500 million to produce. So in those terms, paying five times that amount to create for the Minecraft, IP, which I said last time, I think is actually very important. It could be like Lego. They don't have to keep milking it. They could just keep Minecraft going.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, Minecraft didn't cost that much to make.
No, it didn't. But I mean, you know, is what? Where's Destiny going to be in 5 years' time? I mean, yeah. after the reviews I've read, I'd imagine that Minecraft and its brand would be in a stronger position, especially if Microsoft do something clever and keep it cross-platform. You know, keep the Linux version and the Raspberry Pi special version and, you know, the PS version alongside the Xbox One version. However, I suspect they won't do that. And I suspect that the Minecraft world will suddenly become one of paid add-ons only available through the Windows 9 App Store.
See, I'm not sure they're going to do it now, because it's like with Skype. They've kept the Linux version.
Yeah, yeah. Although we didn't get an update for a long time.
Yes. I've never really used Skype, so I don't keep on top of it.
It was about 2 years in between Windows and OS 10 had an update, and we received parity, or Linux received parity with those versions.
But the one that makes me, I think, might go is the Raspberry Pi version. Because that's the one they've got something to lose on, I think. Because Linux is always just going to be a little side one that they don't care about because it's such a small user base for them. But the Raspberry Pi in schools and education, that's where they've always been pushing it with their cheap licenses and whatnot.
What about APIs and things like that? Do you think they'll force .NET upon Minecraft?
Rewrite it in C#.
Yeah, C#. I think they will do that kind of thing. I think, you know, because they now own, you know, that it's a direct vein to the souls of teenagers.
Well, pre-teenagers, actually, in a lot of cases, yeah. I suppose, yeah, if your first, yeah, instead of being Python, the first programming language could become Visual Basic .NET or something horrible like that.
I mean, I suppose I'm also, there was Notch, the guy who created Minecraft, wrote a quite impassioned post about why he was letting it go. And I have a lot of sympathy for the reasons that he gave, and that he didn't want Minecraft. He never imagined Minecraft would be this big. He didn't want to be in this kind of boss position that he wanted to be. Lots of people have said, you know, it's like Steve Wozniak with Steve Jobs. You know, he's the developer, hacker, tinkerer guy. And so I've got a lot of sympathy for him doing this. But I guess I'm slightly disappointed that it's gone to Microsoft. And he did, for example, years ago or 18 months ago, say that he would open source Minecraft.
When he'd made enough money.
Yeah. and that would have been an incredible gift. I mean, it's not like Notch or Mojang were lacking for money. And I also loved his new idea for a game. You know, it was like a space sim thing. So I'm kind of disappointed that those avenues will perhaps come to an end, and we may see a predictable Microsoft endgame.
well, we'll have to wait and see on that. In more transitioning software, TrueCrypt, which shut down about 6 months or so ago, that's now been reborn as Cypher Shed.
He really trips off the tongue, that, doesn't it?
I'm trying to decide if it's worse than LibreOffice. I'm not sure.
I've got used to LibreOffice. Cypher Shed. It's easy to say Cyber Shed.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's basically the same as TrueCrypt, but the license that TrueCrypt was under specified that it had to be, when if it was forked, it had to be forked under a completely different name that couldn't be confused for or passed off as that. The developers have said that they'll release it under an OSI approved license, but haven't said which one yet.
Yeah, it sounds like that's going to be essentially because all the sort of copyright of the existing code is owned by the original TrueCrypt developers, whoever they are. So they're basically going to have to re-implement it all in order to then be able to re-license it, which is going to be a huge job.
I thought the terms of the TrueCrypt license meant they could use it as long as they obeyed a few things like changing their name.
They can re-release it themselves under the TrueCrypt license as long as they change the name and do all this stuff. But if they want to then change the license, wouldn't they have to change a lot of the other stuff as well?
I thought once they'd removed all references to TrueCrypt from the code, they were then free to relicense it.
Oh, okay.
But I could be wrong on that.
All right. No, they said it involved rewriting a lot of code. I assumed that meant literally rewriting all the code, but maybe it's not as severe as that. which would be good. Let's be honest, because it could do with being under a proper license.
Yeah.
What happened to TrueCrypt 6 months ago? I'm sorry.
Well, they never really said. There's never been, as far as I'm aware, nothing ever came, any more information came out. But one day they just put a post up saying it may not be secure anymore.
Yeah.
Won't be any more releases. Yeah. Stop using it.
Right.
And
so that's that.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, I mean, if they did decide that they just wanted to relicense it, the only way that anyone could argue with them is if the original developers decided to, you know, announce who they were publicly and challenge them in court. So maybe they get away with it.
Well, these guys have been in contact with the original developers.
Right.
All I know is that they said they've been asked not to speak about their contact with the original developers.
Okay. It sounds very polite, but
yes.
what we can all see really is that they've been told that they cannot speak about the people they cannot speak about.
Yeah.
It's super injunctions and free software.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily free software, by the sound of it.
But hopefully it'll be becoming free software.
Yes, absolutely.
Android applications are now running on Linux, sort of, kind of, if you poke them with a stick hard enough.
Yeah. How's that work, then?
It's pretty hacky, to be honest. This is a bit where I realised I didn't really look into it quite enough.
That's not like
I did see one solution where there was some sort of extension for Chrome,
yeah,
which provided like an Android VM, but then you had to repackage the APKs, so you could only use stuff which you could get as a standalone APK.
Yeah, that's... there used to be a way of getting anything on the Google Play Store as an APK. As in a bit of a...
Oh, yeah, that was a funny sort of spoofing thing and sending requests to Google Play, and then I do remember seeing that.
Because I've used that to get stuff on CyanogenMod before.
Ah, right, okay.
I was also really surprised at just how much x86 stuff is on the Google Play Store. I mean, that's also another big issue.
That is... Well, not... No, oh. Well, you might be able to run on top of QEMU or something like that.
Yeah, but, I mean, it depends what level of virtualization we're talking about.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so this Chrome thing, is that only working on ARM systems at the moment then, for running ARM Android apps? Or is there enough abstraction there that it works?
In the standard Play Store, you're right, it is split up into x86 and ARM. The truth is,
there's another wrapper for ARM stuff.
Yeah, I actually don't know.
Because, I mean, when I installed the last version of Android x86, it ran remarkably well. It was actually a viable alternative to, like, I could give it to somebody and they could use it and they could be... I actually used it in one of the Dell XPS 13.
Oh, really? You know, wow.
With the touchscreen.
Yeah.
And it all worked.
The only time I've ever used it is on a Joggler.
Oh.
It wasn't that great, but that's more about the Joggler than about Android, really.
It is just as restrictive as Android, so if you're used to a laptop, then you're going to hit the walls very quickly.
Yeah.
But, you know, first I think I'd prefer Android to Chrome OS in that way, that there's far more, you could install an APK from anywhere, you could do other stuff, you can open up a terminal like from the default running distribution, if that's what it is.
I remember when I last used Android x86, the biggest problem wasn't the way it ran, it was the way it expected input. It was just horrible with a mouse.
Right,
So unless you had a touchscreen, it was always a bit awkward. But
I think Mike Saunders has reviewed a recent version of Android x86 in the latest edition of Linux Voice, which may go on sale today. If I'm doing the hard sell.
Yeah, we'll have to ask him what. Have a look.
Have a look. We only got these today. This is the.
For the benefit of the tape, Graham is now flicking through the latest edition of Linux Voice.
Where do we put reviews now?
The green bit.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, Mike actually gave it. Should I give it away?
That's the only reason he buys the magazine.
4 stars out of 5. Surprisingly good. I should do it in Mike's kind of Germanic northern accent. Surprisingly good and a great my first Linux distro for non-savvy users who do everything on the web. Oh. Actually, Mike's wasted no time in playing games on it.
Well, one of the things I looked at this running Android apps on Linux was for things like iPlayer and 4OD, that you can actually download them the Android version.
I did try Netflix on the x86 version of Android, and it didn't work.
Right.
Did you?
Although the app downloads and installs, so it's actually probably more to do with the whatever the right word is for the device that you're running it on.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
The secret serial number, I suppose, or something.
Or yeah, or maybe the all of the devices which it's expecting to run on have like hardware decoders.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's true.
It didn't have what it was expecting on the XPS.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah. And finally, our last item of news is apparently some game thingy's been released, Graham.
I added this to the news, and everybody got really excited about it on the internet. Is it Counter-Strike Global Operations?
Offensive.
Now, I did actually used to play Counter-Strike a long time ago. It's a very good game.
Right.
It's like the archetypal FPS. It's the terrorists versus the security forces, and each game lasts a few minutes, really, as everybody runs around to try and stop everybody else. This CSGO, being natively released for Linux, it's gone straight to like non-beta. It's the release version. It's like £15 on Steam. I think for people who enjoy Counter-Strike, and there are still tens of thousands of people who play it, it's a significant thing, and it's another step, probably, as it's a Valve game, in Valve's positioning as a Linux games maker. So I think that's why it's significant. Okay, so it's now time for our finds of the fortnight, which I've been reminded is the correct way of saying it. Now, I'm going to have to make an excuse because I've been really busy. I don't really have any finds. We're meeting in Oxford because this is where Mark is. I did spend the afternoon in the Ashmolean Museum hunting out the Rings of Power. but as we have Mark here with us...
Hello.
Yes. He is part of a rather excellent podcast. And it's quite interesting, the UK Linux podcast fraternity, because there is one, really. Or fraternity, maybe, is the wrong word for it.
Community.
Community. How did you get involved in the Ubuntu UK podcast?
Well, I sort of already knew about half of the people involved because we were all members of the Hampshire Linux user group.
And you used Ubuntu?
I didn't originally use Ubuntu, but we all sort of converged on Ubuntu. And then I listened to, like, I think I heard about the podcast through the Lug mailing list. And then I would listen in and email in and just sort of generally be a fan of the podcast for a while. And then they needed someone to stand in because we have a sort of a nominal number of four presenters, and it was down to two for a show, and I live just down the road.
So you all meet up then to do
yeah
this
we
podcast.
Do we do it yeah we all sit in the same room and do it. At the time we did record it and then edit it together and put in the jingles, but now we just power do it through right, and yeah. do it. We stream it live, and then whatever gets streamed, with a few very small exceptions, is exactly what we put out.
It'd be nice if we could do that.
It does make life a lot easier. It means that you don't have much work to do afterwards.
So you don't have any sponsorship from Canonical, although they're obviously very aware of what you're doing. I mean, having Mark Shuttleworth on the show.
Yeah, I mean, we use the Ubuntu name and logo under the community guidelines.
And Alan works for Canonical.
Yeah. He didn't work for Canonical when the show started.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
No. He did some consultancy for Canonical because he was freelance, and then he started working for them, I think, about 3 years ago. But they, I mean, it's not affected anything we do. I mean, Alan has always been a vocal supporter of Ubuntu, and anything he says now in support of Ubuntu in response to any criticism we get is very much that's his opinion, because he really loves Ubuntu, not because they're paying him to say it. I mean, anyone can use the Ubuntu name and logo the same way we do, just as long as they're not passing it off as something else. So we don't have to be nice about Ubuntu just because we use the name. We just have to be talking about Ubuntu. So there's no sort of inherent bias there. It's just that we like Ubuntu, so that's why we're doing a podcast about it.
yeah Has it been going for about 6 years?
I think we're on our seventh year at the moment.
So have things changed in your attitude towards Canonical and Ubuntu over that time, do you think? Have you had to kind of adapt to...
Good question.
So, yeah, 6 or 7 years ago, it was all about perhaps the desktop. You know, now it's very different.
Yes. I mean, I suppose, yeah, the vision that Canonical portray is different. But then I think really so has the market they operate in. So I think from my point of view, I just view it as they have done quite well in shifting with, you know, moving with the times. They've not just said, we're a desktop distribution, we're going to keep making the desktop. They've said, well, these technologies are now perhaps more relevant than desktop. We need to look at how we can exploit them to make it a sustainable thing.
So has that affected the content of the podcast? Does that reflect that? Or are you still kind of Linux geeks who just happen to use Ubuntu?
Well, to be honest, yeah. I mean, the podcast, it's called the Ubuntu podcast, but it's not a podcast about Ubuntu. We have a section where we talk about Ubuntu stuff, but generally we talk about whatever we're interested in. So I don't think that shift has really changed much in terms of the podcast content at all. It's just, you know, the community we're operating in has perhaps broadened a bit.
Okay.
Obviously, you're from the Ubuntu podcast. Is that the reason we're in an Ubuntu themed pub?
Yeah. It is very orange, isn't it?
It's orange, brown,
and there's purple seat covers.
And purple. This must be an Ubuntu pub.
Yeah. I hadn't planned that. I think they might have changed the upholstery since last time I was here. I have to make sure you include a photo of that with the show.
So, I guess my discovery is, if you haven't listened, give it. The Ubuntu UK podcast.
Oh, thank you. That's podcast.ubuntu-uk.org.
That's a very professional reeling off the URL. Yeah.
It's actually great having another podcaster on because you can talk. You know, you ask them questions and people talk. It's really useful for
everyone. Shall I go with my finds now? I've got a couple. This one, I only came across it today, and I haven't had time to download it and try it out yet, but it looks quite interesting. It's called NetHunter from nethunter.com, and it's made by the guys who do Kali Linux, which is a penetration testing distro, so it's all sort of security-wise. But this is it's an image for Nexus devices, so tablets and phones and whatnot, and it's... It includes a few things. It's got some sort of general, and it's a version of Android, I think. I'm pretty sure it is. And it's got a lot of Android utilities for pen testing on. And it's also got a Chroot environment that you can VNC into, like you often can with things. And that's a full version of Linux Kali, or Kali Linux. So on your, you know, your Nexus 7 or your Nexus 10, you can have your complete suite for...
probing. So you can break into someone's network on your phone, leave it there, and then sneak off and remote in and do all your ne'er-do-well activities from afar.
Well, of course. What else would you do with it? As I say, I haven't actually been able to download yet. The webpage was loading appallingly slow this morning.
Have you got internet yet, Ben?
Not at my house. Supposedly it's coming on Friday. So we'll see. They don't seem to have any sort of records of what houses have an active phone line. So we've got a phone line that doesn't have a dial tone, but they can't tell us whether or not that's a proper phone line or whether it's not. So some guy's going to come up on Friday and go, poke it a few times and go, you need some other guy to come and do something else.
Great.
It's like, well, did you not just keep a list of that somewhere?
What an age we live in.
Yeah. I don't know if I've ever mentioned, but I live in a small village, really, and it's a village that happened to have fibre broadband, and it kind of moved its way through the town and passed us by. And when I looked into it, the local council had denied planning permission for the cabinet that was required to be able to get us fibre.
They lost your vote then. Yeah.
Well, it took me, I mean, I didn't do much other than constantly email, you know, like our councillor to say, what's been going on? How is this denied? And it went on for like 4 or 5 years between finally this year, we've finally got the cabinet put up. And, you know, the 100 or 200 houses that they're left out now have a connection, you know, 4 or 5 years later.
But have all their house prices dropped massively because of this ugly cabinet?
But it's just, the whole thing is just trying, I suppose what I'm saying is trying to deal with basically the planning committee, the local councillors, and BT, or Open Reach, the people who kind of are part of British Telecom who go out and install these things, it's actually impossible. And I have an awful lot of sympathy with people trying to do the same thing.
Well, my next discovery, sorry, not discovery, my next find, lest I incur the wrath of the internet, is I have in my hands a graph of subreddits, the number of subscribers in subreddits for different programming languages.
Okay.
So,
did you make this graph yourself?
I didn't, actually. I got it.
Oh, you found it, presumably. Yes, yeah, okay.
There's a sub, I forget actually which one. I think it came from, what's it called? I think it's Data is Beautiful.
Okay.
That subreddit. So, I mean, the first one is pretty obvious. It's Python. Mm-hmm. It's Python by almost twice as many as the next popular.
Wow. Almost, it'd be interesting to see that over time.
Yeah. But I was really surprised by number two. What do you guys reckon what comes in at number two?
PHP, I'd say.
You're both... PHP is closest, but it's not...
You're a PHP developer.
not at all biased in any way.
Python has 80,000 subscribers. PHP has 31,700.
That's not bad.
But second, JavaScript.
Oh, okay.
Of course, yeah.
I think that's more to do with the demographic of people who program in JavaScript. They're just more likely to be on Reddit.
What do you think of JavaScript programmers, Mark?
Well, being a PHP programmer, I'm also a JavaScript programmer, so I think they're brilliant, and I won't hear a word said against them.
Number three, any guesses?
So it's got to become, PHP and JavaScript.
PHP and JavaScript,
yeah. I'd like it to be Ruby, but I don't suppose it is. It's probably something like, I don't think Java people would be on Reddit.
C#.
I don't know why.
Or Objective-C, it'll be the App Store people.
There isn't an Objective-C, oh no, there is. There's both Objective-C and iOS developers.
Right.
So they might have sort of split the vote on that one.
Right. Is that the fourth place? Or
no, it's not. They're both quite way down. Okay. But you shouldn't have doubted yourself. It is Java.
Oh, really? Okay, then. I'm a Java developer as well these days.
Yeah, then PHP. Then there's an Android development one. And it goes... Then they're all quite close together after that. Ruby, C++, Haskell. Quite high up, I thought.
Wow, that is interesting.
But I think that's just Haskell people like to talk about Haskell.
Yeah.
I'm going to get flamed for that.
It'd be interesting to see a comparison of this with Stack Overflow as well.
Oh, that would be interesting. Yeah, and then C# after that. And,
that's a really good discovery.
Yeah.
You often forget about JavaScript, that's the thing.
And it's everywhere now.
It is everywhere, yeah. And it's good that it's everywhere. Java number three, I think, is a real surprise. Yeah. I would never have thought that.
Yeah, two and three really surprised me. The rest is more or less what I'd expect. And Haskell surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, I would have put PHP above JavaScript and then perhaps JavaScript third.
See Swift coming along near the bottom there?
I haven't looked too much into Swift, but from what I've read about it, it's a pity it's not open source. Thanks, Ben. Yeah.
I also have a find for the fortnight. I discovered this yesterday, actually. The Steam beta for Linux at the moment now supports in-home streaming.
Yeah.
Ah.
So it's been around for a while where you could stream to a Linux client since they released SteamOS. But it's just now coming the way you can have Linux as the host. So you can have your powerful Linux, you have your powerful gaming rig running Linux or SteamOS. And then you can have your other less powerful PCs just stream your games from that.
That's a good discovery.
Yeah, and it works. I mean, like, normally you go into your Steam library and you can either play or install a game. But if you've got two machines logged into Steam on your local network, then instead of having an install button, it just has a stream button if it's installed on your other device. And you just click it, and it actually runs. If you have both screens open, you can see it and hear it on both devices.
Yeah.
And then you just control it from the one you're streaming to, and it just works. It's really good.
I have tried it with Windows 8, yeah. and underneath my television, it's actually an old Myth TV box, mm-hmm. so it's very low power. But I turned that into like a SteamOS box,
yeah.
And I do have Windows 8 installed. I never use it, I promise. It's an awful OS, but I thought a couple of months ago when Steam announced this streaming stuff, I thought I'd try it and see how it performed.
Yeah.
Actually, for Witcher... because Witcher was released, and the initial Linux version of Witcher was very poorly ported. In fact, it used a terrible kind of library, which really just... And anyway, it's got a lot better recently. But the streaming technology works very well if you're happy with like 1280 by 720.
Right.
And also the other thing is that my main PC really is noisy.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't really want that in the living room.
Yes.
Late at night when everyone's asleep and I'm typically playing games. And so putting like a thin Linux computer downstairs next to the television works really well.
Yeah. Well, my main concern, because I do have my Steam box is under my TV, and my main concern building that was the noise, because it is fairly powerful. So I would want to use that as my host for streaming games, but it's tricky to build something like that which will fit under your TV and be quiet.
Do you know how intensive it is to stream games to the receiving machine, the client?
No. Although, I mean, they both, you have optionally at both ends to use hardware encoding.
Okay.
So I suspect if you have the relevant hardware to do that at both ends, it's less intensive.
I think if you've got the right GPU, it takes barely anything.
Because I have, our main TV, I don't know, it's one of those things, I can't throw it out because it still works. So we keep this aging TV. It doesn't have HDMI or any digital input.
Right.
So it's great for the Raspberry Pi. So actually, that's what I'm using. I'm using XBMC on a Raspberry Pi, and I've got another Myst TV box streaming it through that. If I could stream from my PC to the Raspberry Pi, that would be wonderful.
Well, yeah, basically, it just needs to be able to decode and display the video and the sound that it's getting and send the control events back. So if it can do that, which I suppose, I mean,
it would depend.
Raspberry Pi can do it fairly well.
It would depend on whether or not there would be GPU codecs, the respective video.
I think a Raspberry Pi might be a little bit too...
I mean, it can decode video.
Yeah.
But then can you get Steam on a Raspberry Pi?
You can't at the moment. ARM, isn't it? At the moment it's not possible.
But there was, I remember it was, I can't remember what it was called now. There used to be an application you could get that streamed games.
Oh, what, did you stream them off? Yeah. Yes, I can't remember what it was called. They lost about
was,
6 months.
Yeah, there was an ARM version of their client.
Oh, really?
And they handled controllers. There was also... a version for Linux running on the PlayStation 3.
Don't Nvidia have some?
Yes, they've got their own thing for streaming to
because of their Shield.
For their tablet devices, you can stream from Nvidia graphics card to their tablet.
Yeah, and I think all that part, the functionality, it's like on the PlayStation 4.
Yeah,
the streaming comes for free.
Yes.
Because it's just some...
Yeah.
It's
I actually played on one of my colleagues. He's got a PS Vita, and I played Minecraft in my office on his PS Vita running on his PlayStation 4 at home over the internet.
It does actually work
it was
quite
just,
well.
It was like magic.
I've got a Vita and a PS4 as well.
Yeah.
Mm. What does that bring us on to?
Thanks, Mark. Well, I will say that we're supposed to get some fines from Andrew and... Mike, so they will be seamlessly edited into the podcast at this point.
Will it be like they were here?
Over to you, Andrew or Mike.
Hello, everybody. Here are my fine discoveries. Defines of the fortnight. Just outside York, on the old, on the stretch of the old East Coast railway line between York and Selby, there's a scale model of the planets of the solar system. Or should I say, should it be the planets... plus Pluto. There's, you know, just outside the ring road, there's a massive model of the sun, which is just a metal sphere about 2 metres across. And then about 50 metres down the path from that, there's a little tiny ball bearing that represents Mercury. And then every so often, you've got a planet, until Pluto is 6.5 miles towards Selby, which is great. It's like a lovely little relaxing, mellow route with the odd bit of science thrown in. There's a scale model of the Cassini's at Space Probe, which is just near a little cafe where you can have a cup of tea. Just science, just accessible there. And nobody's vandalised it, which is great. But somebody has vandalised the Pluto sign to say, Pluto, not a planet. I disagree. Pluto was a planet when I was a lad. If it was good enough for me, then it can be, you know, good enough for the kids of today. Right, that's all. Bye.
Hello, I've managed to tear myself away from Oktoberfest for a few hours to come up with a couple of finds. The first thing I found was when researching Linux Voice Issue 9's cover feature. This is a Firefox extension called Pentadactyl. Basically, it adds a layer of Vim-like keyboard controls to the browser so that you can browse the web without using the mouse at all. So you use the JK keys to scroll up and down, like moving up and down in Vim, and you use H and L to go back and forwards in your browser history and so forth. The way it handles links is especially cool. You just tap F and then every link on the page gets a little yellow label next to it with a number. So you just type that number straight away and the browser goes to the link. I've been using it for a while and I've seen a couple of similar extensions in the last few years that also add Vim-like key bindings to the browser. But Pentadactyl has a lot more and it looks really good. And this leads me on to my second find, which is actually more of a rant, and that is, why does Firefox break extension compatibility so often? I had to install a nightly build of Pentadactyl just to get it to work. Now, I'm using Firefox 32, and the proper release of Pentadactyl, the last official release, only works with Firefox 30. So in those two versions, and that's a very short period of time in the Firefox world, in those two versions, what has architecturally and fundamentally changed so much to break browser extension compatibility? I can understand that older extensions won't necessarily be able to use newer features of the browser, but why can't they have a stable API? Why does there have to be so much breakage? I always see people complaining about this with other extensions as well. I could understand it if this was like early beta releases of Firefox, but this is a very mature, massively used program. And can somebody explain to me why it breaks so often? Anyway, sorry about that. Rant over. Back to the podcast.
And thanks, Andrew or Mike. They were excellent.
Oh, yes, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah. I heartily endorse this event and all product.
Yeah, it's a pity it's the same the same find as Ben came up with. But yeah, we'll just have to. Andrew would now say this is the halfway reminder.
That is not in the halfway, and I'm not entirely sure what it's reminding you about.
No.
But is it reminding you to subscribe to Linux Voice?
I guess so, but we often forget to do that. And it's never at halfway, and I doubt it's at halfway now at 40 minutes in. So that just leaves Voice of the Masses.
Voice of the Masses. Right. In the absence of Andrew, I shall take over.
You seem a lot more prepared than Andrew usually is.
Well,
Ben has printed out the actual responses.
I very nearly got carried away. I went to the website and I thought, well, I need to get a copy of all the responses. So I went on to print preview and obviously got this big page with all the sidebars and everything else and thought, hang on, this is just in a database. I just need another PHP script and it will pull out just the comments and everything. And I was like, I'll just do that. And I was like, actually, no, I've got to go and get the training.
Do you mean you don't have a separate CSS file for printing?
No. I could have just deleted the CSS and see what happens. So yeah, I do have a printout of the 10th. Well, I've got the printout of the 9 and I added the 10th by hand.
So what was the question?
The question is, yes, of course, the question is, are you attending any FOSS events? We're about to go to Og Camp in a week and a half. Is that right?
10 days.
10 days.
10 days.
And I suppose this is a good point to say that Mark helps organise Og Camp.
Yes, I do.
How long have you been involved with Og Camp?
I think this is my fourth year that I've been involved.
And so this year we are sat in a pub in Oxford.
In Oxford, yes.
And Og Camp is in Oxford.
It is.
On the 4th and the 5th of October. However, you've sold all the tickets.
Right, yes. So we have at the moment. By the time this is released, we might have some more tickets. Basically, because it's a free event, people might sign up for a ticket and then not actually show up. So we always oversubscribe just to be on the safe side. And we usually end up with about between 250 and 300 people. It's not happening too near here. It's sort of up the road a bit. But it's in the Oxford Hotel. And there's several hotels around there where people are staying. So if you are interested, then check out oddcamp.org and oddcamp.org/tickets. If the tickets have sold out, there's also a waiting list. So if someone returns a ticket, you'll get another ticket.
You've not been tempted to try and get a bigger venue?
No, because again, it's the sort of the dropout rate is fairly consistent.
Right,
although
right,
interestingly,
okay.
Because we do a pay what you want ticket thing. So interestingly, this year, a lot more people as a proportion of the tickets sold have chosen to give us some money. So I'm interested to see if that affects the rate of dropout.
So it's just sort of a reminder that if you're listening to this in 12 months, put it in your calendar to get 2 tickets and sell one on eBay.
Sell one of the free tickets on eBay,
yeah. It's the free market at work. It's supply and demand.
But yes, also by the time this is out, we'll probably have the schedule online, because as well as it being an unconference, we have some scheduled speakers. So we should have details of those online.
OddCamp is a brilliant thing, which is why we wanted to help in any way we can. Maybe it's worth saying exactly what an unconference is.
Right, so an unconference is like a conference, except that instead of having a schedule which is decided in advance, people come along and they offer talks, and then the attendees vote on the talks they'd like to see, and if your talk's popular enough, it'll get scheduled. So basically the way we do it is we have a system which was written by John the Nice Guy Spriggs, who I believe was mentioned on the last show. PHP. a system called Campfire Manager. So basically the way it works is you log in, you submit your talk. If it gets more than 2 people want to see it, then it gets scheduled. And then depending on how many people vote for it, it gets assigned to a room for the right size. And then if there's too many, then it'll get bumped off and assigned to another slot. So yeah, it's all very, very disorganized and somewhat democratic and good fun.
It is good fun.
Yes, you've been before, Graham.
I have, yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear
that. I loved it, in fact. Having gone to, I think I've said this before on the podcast, so I don't want to labour the point, but having been to so many kind of geek gatherings in the past, and all of them are good in their own way, but I felt like I was at home at OddCamp.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that people say, like, we always have a bit of a feedback at the end, because we always finish with a raffle, so if you want to come and win some cool geeky prizes, then, we have a raffle at the end. And yeah, we always ask people what they enjoyed about OddCamp, or what was their highlight. And we always get people saying that it's a really friendly event, which I mean, we don't try to hit a particular tone with it, but it's the community that makes the event, and they make it really friendly. So even if you don't normally feel at home at that kind of event, you might still enjoy it.
And it's just you guys organizing it on your own. I mean, we were talking earlier, we're in Oxford, so the venue is in Oxford, so you've been like the person negotiating with the venue.
So yeah, it's
not like it's all in your spare time. This is purely done for the love of it.
Yes, it's for quote unquote fun. I do it because I want OddCamp to happen, basically. That's what it comes down to.
Right,
yeah,
on with the listeners. Daniel is tempted to make the trip to linux.conf.au, which is confusing. Well, he says it's in New Zealand, but it's .au, which I always thought was Australia.
I always thought it was in Australia.
Maybe it's mixing things up a bit. I don't know. I'm tempted to go to New Zealand.
That's the one.
He said it's only $150 for flights, and we can probably afford that. It's possible he's not travelling from Bristol. I don't know.
I'd always wanted to go to LinuxConf in Australia, because that's the one that Linus always attends.
Really?
Yeah. He's always there every year. Apart from that, I've never been to Australia, and I'd love to go. But I think Linus might go because there's some great scuba diving.
Possibly. Of course.
Or, you know, if you were getting your expenses paid for a trip to Australia.
Yes. And it's probably paid for or sponsored by the Linux Foundation, his employees. Yeah.
We could make a point of just going to Lord of the Rings themed Linux conferences. Start with the Oxford one and move on to New Zealand. Who else have we got? Alex B is lucky because his employer funds his trips.
It's great that I assume the employer knows how best to spend their money rather
That's
than
true.
Just sending you on, you know, a team building exercise in the forest.
That's not what Linux Voice does. Before anyone gets the wrong idea. Not that there's anything wrong with team building events in the forest. We just choose not to. Liam Dorr says, sadly, there seems to be next to nothing in Devon. Ooh. So, Liam, who's, of course, our gaming editor, perhaps it's time for Devon Fest.
Yes. Well, if any fellow Devon people who live there, I'm sure there's a word for that.
Devonians
know of a FOSS event going on down that way, let Liam know.
Yeah, cream tea and Linux. What could be better? Brian says he's taking advantage of Stormen coming to Montreal.
Interesting. I saw Stormen last time he spoke in Oxford, which was an experience.
Where did he speak?
He spoke at one of the colleges. I can't remember. It began with a W. That's as far as I can get, I'm afraid.
Was it long ago? Because he's in the country quite often.
It was probably about six or 9 months. Right. Looking at the weather, I think it was probably about this time last year now that I think about it.
Yeah. It's probably best not to go into how you found it.
It was Richard Stallman. It was, you know, not far off what I expected. It was funnier than I expected, actually. He's got, you know, he knows. The thing is, he says things which are funny, but I don't think he finds them as funny as the audience does.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he does things which are definitely meant to be funny, like putting a hard disk clatter on his head and pretending he's Saint Ignatius. And, you know, he made some very valid points and some, you know, in my opinion, slightly less valid points. But there you go.
A lot of his talks are available online if you don't have a chance to go and see him. Yes. I forget exactly where, but I'm sure we can put it in the notes.
I had a phase about 6 weeks ago of constantly watching Richard Stallman talks online. I've got over that.
One thing I've always wanted to do with the cover disc on the magazine is make it so it's both a video disc and a bootable live disc. And I think it's technically possible.
But nobody has video disc players anymore.
No, DVD.
DVD, okay.
So yeah, DVD video and...
You used to get CDs, but if you put them in your computer, they had like secret features.
Yeah exactly. Yeah. I think it's technically possible. It's probably widely incompatible with just about every player ever made, but there's probably
Will
one
it be
somewhere.
As successful as your experiment with EcoDiscs?
that was our previous employer.
Oh, yes, of course, sorry.
But yeah, that was a disaster.
They worked fine for me, but I didn't have a slot loading MacBook or
many
anything.
Many people we have. I mean, Future Publishing had an awful lot of number of complaints, but they were cheaper and they were more, you know, environmentally
friendly, weren't they? Which is great because, you know,
I think
I just took them off and threw them away and downloaded the software instead.
Oh, that's a blast from the past.
I remember, I forget who we were meeting with, one of our distributors or printers or something like that, and they suggested them to Linux Voice, and Mike just laughed in their face. on with the comments. To be frank, is off to FOSDEM 2015. Oh,
I went to FOSDEM last year for the first time. It was brilliant.
Yeah. I've never been to FOSDEM.
Oh. You've never been?
No, which is amazing. Well, the way things worked out, you know, at the old magazine, you know, we try and spread it around, and by the time it came to FOSDEM, somebody else's turn to go.
It's just, I mean, it's crazy because there's just so much going on, but, you know, you've got talks about everything and Belgian beer on your doorstep.
I would love it if we had the budget to be able to go, you know, in January, February.
It's only £20 on Eurolines.
Yeah, if we book now, if we were organised and actually booked ourselves out of there now, we should do it.
Get on couch surfing, it'll be fine.
Yeah. I'd love to go. It seems to be like the most significant event in the way that people talk about it in terms of the grassroots kind of free software movement.
Certainly in Europe. Yeah, and talking of events, actually, I would like to go to. Stuart says he's just come back from EMF camp.
Oh, yeah.
Which looked, I was a
that
day
did, on, I looked amazing.
It was the weekend I was moving house, otherwise I'd have gone. But it looks...
And it's one of the few camps where you're actually camping.
Yeah.
Well. It's actually in a field with tents.
Apparently they had good weather in the end, but they, prepared for the worst and put cables underneath all of the turf and stuff like that, so...
Wow.
We'll have to try and do that. I mean, I've been camping this summer as well, so I'm back in the camping kind of groove. We can do it.
Some people sometimes go camping at Odd Camp, actually.
Really? It started when we were in Farnham. There was a campsite not too far away, and so there was an Og camp, a Camp Og camp.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, we've put it as an option for this year because there's a campsite like in Oxford which people might be camping at. I don't know.
And it's a really mild autumn here at the moment. You know, it'd be quite nice.
It's a lot cheaper than staying in a hotel.
Matt's, who knows how to pronounce O's with double dots over.
Sjulberg? Sjulberg? Is that it? I don't know. That was a guess.
Yeah. Apologies, Matt. We're brutalising your name. Something like Matt Sjulberg. We'll be attending FSCons in Gothenburg. Gothenburg. That just sounds cool. And apparently Theroux will be as well.
Oh, excellent.
Cool. Obviously a popular conference.
Yes. Yeah, so I haven't actually heard of it before.
No, I haven't.
And he'll be going to Fosdem as well.
Yes, Theroux will be at Fosdem.
So it's quite European-centric, the responses we've had. I mean, it was a pretty mild question in comparison to our normal.
You're implying that Americans only like to be angry on the internet.
No, I would genuinely be interested to know what the US equivalent of Fosdem is. I don't know.
Is it not OSCON? Or is OSCON more enterprisey and business-focused?
I think just by the cost of OSCON alone, you know, to attend OSCON, it costs, I don't know, £1,500 or £1,000.
Right.
It's something that people with understanding managers get sent on. And it's a great event, but it's not something that mortals can afford to go to.
Yeah. It's one of the funny things about Fosdem, just the size of it and you just turn up. You don't even register. I have literally no idea how they manage that.
Does it surprise you that we haven't got something more similar, perhaps? I mean, this is Og Camp is maybe the closest to Fosdem that we have in the UK.
Yes, but, you know, about sort of a tenth or a twentieth of the size. I guess, no, I mean, I think having it in Central Europe makes sense for something of that size, really.
I think the thing about it is the location. It's just, they can only really run it the way they do because the university is so understanding.
Yes, yeah.
And I actually know some people who attended that university, and this could have got lost in translation, but they told me that there were no limits on how many people could register for courses. You just signed up for your course, and sometimes, you know, lecturers would be overflowing down the corridors, other times it'd be almost empty, but it's literally, if you want to go to that university, you can go. That's it. And they were really surprised that it wasn't like that in the UK. And I was really surprised that it was like that in Belgium.
Yeah.
But
it's quite one thing. It's one of the idiosyncrasies of Belgium is that it's held at the Free University of Brussels.
Yeah.
But there's two Free Universities of Brussels. There's a French Free University of Brussels and a Dutch Free University of Brussels.
Does that not make the German speaking Belgians really angry?
I have no idea. I just spoke English.
Yeah.
Are you going to go in 2015?
I'm going to try my best. Again, it depends on my whether I can get work to pay my travel.
Gregory Wellington, who says he's going to Og Camp.
Oh, himself. Good man.
But he's bringing his kids along. So that's
now, I had trouble getting babysitting for our kids, so I was, until just a few days ago, going to bring my kids as well.
We do actually get a surprising number of full families coming along. It's you know, we get quite a diversity of age. It's really good to see, actually, because, you know, we have stuff which is probably just as interesting to kids as anyone else, especially the exhibition.
This is something OSCON did this year, isn't it? They made kids thing.
And considering what I'd said about price at OSCON, in fact, the kids' tracks were a minimal amount, $20 or $30 for like 8 hours of pretty intensive. Really, I sat in on the Sunday on one of these, and it was like a primer for proper university education.
Wow.
Because and the kids really responded well to it. So you kind of listen to someone talk for 45 minutes, and then you're given the hardware to go and play with it. Then you talk about your experience, and then in the afternoon there's a different kind of session. Yeah. And it did work really well. Yeah. And it's very popular.
We have had a suggestion as a sort of fringe event called Sprog Camp.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
We have, you know, kids running.
Is that Les?
It wasn't actually. No, it was someone else who's done. I did a session last year on how to run an Og Camp, encouraging people to get involved. And someone came to me afterwards and suggested they run that But yeah, it would be great to actually be able to do something like that, because yeah, because we get so many kids along, to be able to have kids, like, you know, teaching one another would be perfect, because there are so many kids these days who know, you know, people playing with Raspberry Pis and doing stuff at school and doing stuff at like scouts and things like that, who just know so much, and other kids who are interested in it. It'd be great to do something.
I think they really like the formality of oh look, this is somewhere that I know this stuff. This is something I'm interested in. I can feel part of something when you're not really used to it at that kind of age, and you know, it's something you only kind of realise later on.
I periodically go to help run an event. I help run sessions at an event called DigiMakers in Bristol, which is for kids, getting them involved in Raspberry Pi. And they've got all sorts of like Lego Mindstorms. I think there's a guy that sometimes turns up with an Oculus Rift.
Walking in.
Just keeps walking into walls. what's it, Magpie there as well, and it's the kids going really well there. It's run by the University of Bristol actually, so you've got a load of students helping out, just sort of there's a lot of I assume computer science students helping out with the sessions, and it works well. If you're in Bristol, check it out. And the final comment, John the nice guy Spriggs, who we talked about, said he can't make it to give his talk about Campfire Manager.
He can't attend this year.
No, he's I hope he doesn't mind me saying, he's just had another child, and they're, you know, doing the parenting thing. Yeah.
So what happens when a Campfire Manager breaks down?
We switch to a paper-based
paper airplanes,
post-it notes, and a big sheet of, you know, flip chart or something. We will have a backup. Don't worry. I had a backup last year and we didn't have to use it, so that just, you know, speaks volumes about the quality of John's coding.
Yes. I was going to say earlier that when I was a teenager, I was a real Amiga fan, and I came to like Amiga World in London, and it was like communion, and it felt brilliant being amongst other people who felt the same way. But that was all organised by Commodore, and Free Software and Linux, we don't have that kind of central organizational structure, you know, and the comments that we've seen and the kind of events that we go to shows that if you want to have an event like that, you really have to do something yourself, which is quite brilliant. And that, from what I've seen and read about, there's a lot of people, more people perhaps being interested in going to, maybe not Linux user groups, but hackerspaces are doing really well.
Yeah.
That kind of whole thing. There's a bit of a resurgence, or the pendulum is swinging back up in the way that people want to actually spend all day in front of computers. They want to talk to real people and, you know, spend an hour or two, just like we've done here, you know, with people who have, you know, similar interests. So that's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, being a geek is much more a socially accepted thing these days, and so it's therefore a much more sociable thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no one's thrown us out of here. We're stealing their electricity.
Don't have to hide behind IRC screens anymore. And
I have been at a LUG meeting where there are people, like, literally opposite sides of the desk chatting on the desk, and it's just unbelievable, but, you know.
And I think that brings us to the end of this podcast. But it's been great. It's been great to have you with us, Mark. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me on.
For taking the time. And thanks for travelling all this way, Ben.
And thanks to Linux Voice for sponsoring Ogcam. You guys are going to be running a stand, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. We've ordered some mugs and T-shirts.
Oh, brilliant.
And I've got stickers on my to-do list. I haven't done them yet. But we are. We're going to... The first time we've ever done anything like this, so it'll be interesting.
Cool.
And that's it. So yeah, I'll camp 4th and 5th of October in Oxford, in
the Oxford
England.
Hotel.
Not
Oxford in America. You'll be disappointed if you end up.
The Linux Voice team are all meeting up there, so that means we're going to do a real live recording of the next podcast together, and also means that we'll probably have to do it in about 10 days' time. So we can't slip any longer. So we'll see you all then. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.